From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, comic method acting. Charles Grodin tells us how he went from playing the heavy on TV westerns to landing starring roles in The Heartbreak Kid and Midnight Run. Also today, we meet veteran Tex-Mex rocker Doug Somm. Back during the British invasion of the 60s, he made it big posing as a Brit in the Sir Douglas Quintet. Somm has his first American album in 7 years, featuring his recordings of regional hits of the 50s and 60s. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album from singer-songwriter James McMurtry, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the movie adaptation of the Broadway hit Shirley Valentine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There was an overnight extradition from Colombia as U.S. officials flew to Atlanta, a man suspected of being a financier of the Medellin drug cartel. Ed Hula has more on the story.
Eduardo Martinez Romero arrived in Atlanta under heavy guard before dawn on a Drug Enforcement Administration plane. He was indicted in March on money laundering charges by a federal grand jury. Appearing before a U.S. magistrate this morning, Martinez Romero spoke through an interpreter and said he didn't understand the charges against him and asked for time to study them. Martinez Romero is now scheduled to be arraigned Monday morning. In the meantime, he's being held without bond in an undisclosed location, and the Atlanta FBI office says its agents are on an increased state of alert to guard against any retaliation from the Medellin cartel over the extradition of Martinez Romero. For National Public Radio, this is Ed Hula in Atlanta.
The family of the man the U.S. Navy has tied to the explosion on the USS Iowa earlier this year does not believe the official findings and wants another investigation, this time by Congress. The Navy says the explosion that killed 47 sailors was most likely caused by gunner's mate Clayton Hartwig, who died in the blast. A sister of Hartwig, Kathleen Kubasina, says some of the families of the other men who died in that explosion have been supportive.
We've been in touch with a few of the families who lost people in that turret explosion, and they're on our side. They said that the Navy is basically trying to cover their own selves, and we got word from a few families, just, you know, keep your heads up and you have nothing to be ashamed of. Those men in that turret were under a lot of pressure, and it was an accident.
The Navy investigation also found deficiencies in procedures on board ship, finding pre-fire briefings were poorly attended and poorly conducted. An armored car guard was killed and two other men were seriously wounded during a holdup inside the Bank of America headquarters in San Francisco today. Police say it appears two robbers, wearing ski masks and baseball caps, followed a pair of Brinks guards into the 55-story building, and then for some reason opened fire outside the door to a Bank of America branch. There is no word on what was taken in the holdup, if anything. More than 160,000 students in the United States are getting extra vacation time because their teachers are out on strike. There are now teachers on the picket line in 9 states, including Rhode Island, where teachers' strikes are illegal. The largest single district to be struck is Sacramento, California, where 47,000 students are affected by a walkout. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 13 points to close at 2,706.88 on volume of 161,101,000 shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Perhaps the dumbest career move Charles Grodin ever made was turning down the leading role in The Graduate. They were willing to pay him only $500 a week, and he was already getting twice that as a guest star on TV westerns. Dustin Hoffman negotiated the fee up to $750, and you know how that story ends. It took Grodin a long time to establish himself in films. He had supporting roles in Rosemary's Baby, Heaven Can Wait, and It's My Turn. In the years the movie roles weren't coming, he wrote, directed, and produced for TV and the theater. He also starred on Broadway in Same Time Next Year. Now Grodin is best known for his roles in The Heartbreak Kid, King Kong, The Lonely Guy, and last year's hit Midnight Run, in which he co-starred with Robert De Niro. Charles Grodin has written an autobiography called It Would Be So Nice If You Weren't Here. Although Grodin is now thought of as a comic actor, he didn't start out in comedies. One of his early auditions was for a TV action series called Hawk about an American Indian detective.
Oh, I was, I was at the very beginning of my career. I think I was in my early 20s, and they had me come in. There was a new, I think it was CBS, had a new series, an adventure action series starring an American Indian detective called Hawk. I knew that he was a character that had a knife strapped to his leg under his pants, and that if he didn't like something you were doing, he would leap in the air and kick you in the face. And they were having me in to talk about being on this series, and I didn't know what part it was. So there were some people in there from the network and two or three people, and I was really raw. I hadn't done hardly anything, enough that they were interested in maybe be playing a part there. And they told me all about Hawk, how he was this American Indian, and he like leaped over this and threw people over that and mostly kicked you in the face. And then he told about this woman that he had an involvement with and another woman that he had an involvement with. And I was sitting there nodding my head and really hadn't said anything. And then they were looking at me as though they expected me to say something. And so I said, well, it's interesting, but you've now described three parts to me, none of which I'm even remotely possible for. Why exactly are you telling me all this? And they said, well, what do you think an American Indian looks like? And I realized that they were actually talking to me about being Hawk, this Indian guy who kicks you in the face. So I did a real quick turnabout thinking, God, I could be like a star of a big series and kick people in the face. He said, what do you think an American Indian looks like? I said, like me, exactly like me. But I think I paused too long. So they got the guy who was in the waiting room when I went out, Burt Reynolds.
Yeah, right. Now, you even played the heavy on an episode of The Virginian.
I played a lot of villains in Westerns. I never left my feet and kicked anyone in the face, but I was in a lot of Westerns. It was just necessity. I had co-authored and directed an off-Broadway musical, and we had a disastrous opening night because the costume lady hadn't been paid, and she stole the costumes. So the police had to go after her, and we just had a show that really looked like it was going to be a success. It was a disaster, and I had a baby daughter at the time, and I just had to make a living, and I went out to Hollywood and found that all they really had was dominated by Westerns. So I became a cowboy, and I had never ridden a horse or anything, but there I was this cowboy.
But you were the bad guy a lot.
I was always the bad guy because the star was the hero.
Right. Well, were you good at being menacing?
Well, you know, after this was in 1966, 67, I went out there. By that time, I had so much rejection in show business, I was very good at being menacing. The one thing that all the young actors could do was play rage and menace, because that's what they felt. We were so shut out all the time that you could only say when they didn't want you, thank you very much. You could never really express all this frustration. So a lot of us were good villains.
Have you ever heard overheard conversations about your looks in terms of whether you would have made it as a good leading man?
I try to get into these rooms where they're having these meetings so I can overhear what they're saying, but they usually catch me. Even today, if I'm out in Hollywood, I try to get around the back door of a studio to see if I can overhear some conversations about my looks. But it's hard to get in there to overhear them.
Mm-hmm. My guest is actually...
What do you mean? Or when I go to overhear conversations about my look, are they having them somewhere? You mean, maybe, would you put that a different way?
I see your point.
Yeah.
Right.
Have you ever overheard anything about how much money you have? No, I've never overheard anything about that. Have you ever overheard anything about your weight? Yes, I did overhear the other day my wife and my daughter were talking about, is he fat or what? No, he's not, just the way he's standing. I overheard that.
Well, I figure there's some things casting directors discuss in front of you and some that they don't, but things that you find out anyways whether they discuss it in front of you or not. Have to be discussing, well, I don't know, is he handsome enough for this
there
role?
They discuss everything, and you know, one of the blessings is that you don't hear all the things that they're saying. I mean, I have an agreement with the people that represent me, is I really only hear if they want me. I mean, they definitely know not to call me every day and tell me all the things that they don't want me for. You know,
right.
That movie with Paul Newman, that one with Clint Eastwood, that one with Ryan O'Neal and Robert Redford, they don't want you for that. Thanks for being in touch. Thanks. And there's one coming up they want Jack Nicholson for. They don't want you for that. Oh, good. Good. Like, good to know that. You know. And Michael Keaton, that Batman thing, they wanted him. They didn't want you. Oh, really? Yeah, I kind of assumed it when I saw the movie because we hadn't heard anything about it. Yeah, well, they definitely didn't want you. They didn't want you for the Nicholson part in that either. Right. Okay, good. Well, thanks. I like to hear all this. No, I don't. I really try to not to think about it. That's why I think I spend so much time thinking about sports.
Oh, yeah, right.
I'm afraid of what I might think about.
Well, how did you get from being like the bad guy and auditioning for action series to specializing in comedy, which it seems is what you've done over the past few years?
Well, I was really trained as a serious actor, and Elaine May, really with the Heartbreak Kid, knew me socially, and it just was intending to star me in whatever movie she was going to direct. She just felt that she had this guy that she was going around telling everybody how good I was, and everybody said, if he's that good, why don't we see him? And he says, well, when he has a chance, you will see it. But show business is so much about opportunity that, you know, as I've said, if Dustin Hoffman hadn't been The Graduate, nobody would know what he was doing, because he was about heading out of the acting profession around that time. He was really, he had actually done some off-Broadway shows, but just before that, he had about given it up. And I really lost interest in it, too, right around 1965. It just was too difficult. You could be in a success and not get anywhere. But I was really put into The Heartbreak Kid as a comedy player and then totally perceived that way. Before that, it was just, you know, whatever you could do. I never wanted to be in a sitcom. I just didn't like that kind of rhythm playing. I was doing something different, and I wouldn't have fit in. So that's an extremely murky answer to your question.
Well, explain what it is that you feel like you do different from, for instance, the acting in a sitcom.
Well, a sitcom is based a lot on rhythm. There's a setup and there's a punchline, a setup and a punchline, and I don't really do that. I just basically try to be alive in a situation, and I'm not really wanting to do jokes. Most of the humor that comes out of me has nothing to do with a funny line. It has to do with just being there. So I'm not, somebody said to me once, do you practice these looks in front of a mirror? I don't even know what I'm doing. I just know that I'm alive there in the situation. And that's what, if you ever, when you saw Candid Camera, these people weren't actors, but they were alive in a situation and their normal, honest responses were funny. And that's basically what I'm doing. I've really been trained to be able to be as though I were in life on the screen. And that's what I'm basically doing. Just existing there, and then whatever's going to come out of me. Now, you know, if somebody like who is not maybe a humorous person in life did that, it wouldn't necessarily come out funny. But if you took a person who was humorous in life and they could do that, it probably would come out.
My guest is actor Charles Grodin, and he's written an autobiography called It Would Be So Nice If You Weren't Here. So you're trained in the method. You studied with Uta Hagen and with Lee Strasberg. Do you feel like you use the method in doing comedy roles?
Well, and to the extent that basically what it is that I function as an actor the way I'm functioning right now. I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm responding personally to you. That's basically at the heart of it. It's a personal response. Now, the difference is, these are not written lines that I'm saying to you now. Well, most everything I say is written. I actually wrote down all these things and hope you'd ask some of these questions. That's the difference. And then the skill is to be able to take the lines of the script and make it your own and make it come out of you naturally. But it's so you do apply it all the time.
When you were making Midnight Run with Robert De Niro, can you compare how you each prepared for your roles?
Well, in terms of the background of the part, Bob does a lot. He would like to live the life of the character. He actually went on drug bust with a bulletproof vest because his character did this kind of thing. Even though he didn't do it in the movie, this was part of being the character of Jack Walsh, who he played. I don't really do that. My focus is much more on what's going on right there at the moment. I just accept the fact that I'm an accountant who embezzled money from the mob and gave it to charity. I just accept that, and then I'm there with this guy. I just accept the situation, but I don't really go around embezzling money from the mob in preparation for the role.
So what kinds of differences does that make for when you're actually doing a scene together?
None whatsoever, because what he does is it just brings him to the point where he can be alive in the moment, and what I do brings me to the same point, that we're both doing the same thing. If there's one thing unique about us working together that I found different than a lot of other situations, that I believe in something I learned from Paul Muni in a book that Paul Muni wrote years ago, that you should, if you have a scene and say it's three pages long, for example, mm-hmm. you could learn those lines, but there's learning the lines and there's learning the lines. And I believe in learning the thing, so you could do it 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You could say, just as tools, that you could say these words so fast. So I believe in going over the thing and running it, just as the words, not how you're going to do it, not the interpretation, not the meaning, nothing like that. Just the tools, the words themselves. I would do that an unending amount of time to get it so solid with me that I know it just as quickly as I know the alphabet or counting to 10 or my own name. And Bob agrees with that. So we would sit there and maybe do that 100 times, which is a lot. I mean, it takes a very long time to run a three-page scene 100 times, but there would be no limit, because he understood that once you do that and you go in front of the cameras, you're completely free to come alive and do anything. You're never thinking about your words. And too many actors, they think they've done the work, but they haven't done it. And it affects their work. And I've seen friends of mine, they say, what do you think? And I say, I don't think you know the lines well enough. And they say, no, I know them. I knew them at home. This is different, though. There's cameras. There's 50 people around. The distractions are tremendous. You've got to be so solid before you can really be free and be creative. And that's something I think he understands, and it's what I do, and it had a lot to do with the freedom you see in the playing.
Well, I want to talk with you more about acting and about your life, but first we'll take a short break. My guest is actor Charles Grodin, and he's written a new autobiography called It Would Be So Nice If You Weren't Here. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Charles Grodin is my guest. When you shot The Heartbreak Kid, and you talked about that as being a kind of breakthrough role in comedy for you, you read for Neil Simon. He loved your performance. Then you were reading for him again, but this time you thought you'd already gotten the role, and you were doing what you describe as exploring the character.
Right.
He hated your reading in this,
right.
And he wanted to fire you, which he didn't do. But can you describe what you were doing second time around?
It's the difference between performing, which you sometimes, in that case, certainly had to do to get the part. And, you know, it might be something like this. I might say, Mr. So-and-so, I'd like to talk to you about your daughter. I really like her, and I'd really like to, you know, maybe you and I could talk, and I could, you know. Now, that's like actually talking to someone and trying to do something. But if you were just exploring, it might come out more like, Mr. So-and-so, I'd like to talk to you about your daughter. I like her. I've really met her. In other words, what I'm doing the second time is I'm kind of just letting the situation and the reality of what it is I'm talking about. It's a work process that I'm just trying to feel my way through it. I'm not trying to be effective. I'm just working on my own. But the mistake I did is you don't want to work on your own in front of Neil Simon. He'll think that's what you're going to do. In fact, Eddie Albert, I don't know if I mentioned that in the book, but he too said, is this the guy that's playing the part? You know, I think you kind of owe it to the writer until rehearsals start anyway to let them keep seeing you perform it. But since I'd already performed the whole script for him and actually did a screen test and performed it some more, I thought that they had already seen that. But I was giving them credit for more sophistication than they really had.
You played the gynecologist, the first gynecologist in Rosemary's Baby, which was directed by Roman Polanski. And you tell a really funny and also very interesting story in your book about a pause that you wanted to put in a line. Would you tell that story and explain the significance of the pause to you?
Mia Farrow comes to me for help and says that she feels that these witches and demons, whatever it is, are pursuing her. And at the end of this long tale, which sounds insane to me as a doctor, I'm supposed to say, you may be right, and then I'm supposed to make some phone calls to help her. Well, I felt if she told me that whole story and I said, you may be right, the audience would say, like, well, why? It's very unlikely. He'd just believe that. So when she finished the story, I looked at her for a long time as though I was considering what she'd said, and I very slowly said, well, you know, you may be right. And then Roman Polanski, the director, leaped up and says, take out that pause. And I explained my point, that which I just made here. And he says, no, it's not more believable if you have a pause. It's less believable. So I really didn't agree with him. It was my first picture, and he was a famous director at the time. And I kind of did it with less of a pause. At the end of the day, I went up to him and I said, you know, Roman, I was thinking about what you said what you told me this afternoon. And you know something? And then I took the longest pause you can imagine. And I said, I think you're right. He says, good, that's right. That's what I'm saying. I said, did you just believe me? He says, yes. I said, but I'm lying. That's what I wanted to do in the scene. And he looked at me, and you could see he was trying to figure out whether he hated my guts or admired me. And he decided he admired me, and he threw his arm around my shoulders. Come with me, watch the film from the previous day. And we go in, and the next day, after he had time to sleep on it, he realized that he hated my guts after all. And for the rest of the movie, I said, Roman, he said, I don't care what you do, no matter what I would want to ask. Because that's a European director. There's a problem with some of them. I haven't had that much experience with them, but they are more autocratic, just the same way, you know, certain men of other cultures are. They don't really believe in give and take. They believe more in you take, they give.
Well, this must be a constant source of anguish for an actor deciding whether you should go with your own intuition on how to play something or go with the director's advice.
It doesn't really come up for me. My relationship with directors that I work with, and it's been true for several years, is I like them to see what I'd like to do. If they don't like it, that's fine. But I don't really have that was a unique problem. Generally speaking, I can't really think offhand of anyone asking me to do something that I thought was inappropriate. There was a play I was in once where they wanted me to, when the woman opened the door, they wanted me to fall into the room as though I was leaning against the door. And I said, gee, I really would rather not do that. And the director said, I know that's going to get a laugh. I said, well, I know it's going to get a laugh from some people in the audience too, but it's going to really take away the credibility that this is an actual person. It will look like an actor doing a bit. And he took my point, and I didn't do it. I mean, when people say they got a laugh, and you hear performers say this sometimes, they kind of laugh if somebody laughs. But if you have 800 people in an audience and three people laugh, I consider like 797 people were just bored by what you did. That's not a laugh. So the demands that I put on what's a laugh are different. But generally, if my understanding with directors now is I will have things to say, I'll like to try this and do this and whatever, and you be in charge and you choose and you make the judgment, and all I want you to do is to see it. And it works very well that way. Everybody, as long as it's very clear that they're in charge, the director is comfortable, and I'm comfortable because he has to be in charge. I don't want to try to be in charge. If I'm in charge, then I'll be in charge. But essentially, it's the director who's in charge.
There have been times when you were unable to stop yourself from laughing. You tell the story in your book of when you were playing with Ted Knight, who played Ted Baxter, the newsman on the Mary Tyler Moore Show,
in a
soap opera, an afternoon soap opera, and you had a lot of scenes together, and every time you'd be on the set together, you would just break up. Was that because of the knowledge of the absurdity of the whole program?
Well, we were very
doing?
Good friends off screen, and we really had a lot of laughs off screen, but the real problem was that we were playing, as you do in many soap operas, a variation on one scene, and the scene was that he was my boss, and I would constantly come in and ask him if Irene Forsythe, who was my mother-in-law in the show, the character's name was Irene Forsythe, if she had anything to do with me getting my job here at Forsythe Industries, which of course she did, you know. And this scene, we must have played this scene, I don't know what, a dozen times over a period of time. So when I'd come in and I'd say, you know, can I have a word with you? Yes, Matt, what is it? Did Irene Forsythe have anything to do with me getting my job here at Forsythe Industries? Now, Matt, we've discussed this before. And, you know, and we had discussed it many times. And Ted kind of used like an English accent on the show. Oh, Matt, I don't think this is anything we should be discussing. And we couldn't do it. We just couldn't do it. I mean, here we, you know, like 2 weeks later, Ted, can I have a word with you? Yes, Matt, what is it? I just was thinking this afternoon, and I was wondering if, did Irene Forsythe have anything to do with me getting my job on Forsythe? Now, Matt, we couldn't do it. We just like look at us. Oh, please don't ask me this question again. Yes, she got your job. You stink. You couldn't get a job on your own. All right, leave me alone. You know, but we never said that. We just kind of like made it another scene. But the hardest time I ever had in a movie is something I didn't write about in the book, but you could almost see it in the movie of The Heartbreak Kid when I have a showdown scene with Eddie Albert. And he tries to buy me away from marrying Sybil Shepherd, and I somehow get into a speech about how I was in the service and during the war, and that I, to show what a tough guy I am, I say, you know, and I was in the armed forces of our country, and I fought every moment for 3 years, and I fought every moment of those 3 years, and the line in the script was, not overseas, unfortunately, because of a minor back condition. And I couldn't get through that scene because I was so, you know, I fought for our country for 3 years. Not overseas, unfortunately, because, and I couldn't get through it. And even now, if you look at the movie, you'll see, like, at that moment, I'm, like, staring at the floor, like, biting my tooth off. You know?
You said that sometimes you tell a joke with such a straight face that people take you seriously. Has that gotten you into any trouble recently?
I think it's always gotten me into trouble. It's something I've tried to rectify. I don't know. I mean, I make an assumption about things sometimes that what I'm saying is so absurd it couldn't possibly be taken seriously. But, you know, people read expression more than they do content. And I've learned that, and I really don't like that. I mean, I really don't like to mislead people or to fool people or anything like that. I mean, and it's happened many times. In fact, you know, many people, you know, have been uncomfortable. I remember Warren Beatty, who's a pretty smart guy, saying to me, I don't know what if you're kidding or not. Well, when he said it to me, it really struck me because he's very quick. He's a very hip guy, and if he couldn't tell, then, you know, what am I trying to do? I'm not trying to put something over on people. I'm trying to amuse people. If they really don't know what I'm doing, then I have to do something differently. And I have in recent years attempted to not have that happen.
So you don't do that anymore?
No, I really try not to do it. I mean, I can still fumble into it. Yeah. I remember the first time I met Elaine May, she came in and said, Gene Wilder says such wonderful things about you. And she being Elaine May and such a famous comedic person, I said, boy, you're really coming on to me, aren't you? She was so embarrassed. It was so tense. You know, and it wasn't until like later in the afternoon that she started to see, oh, I was kidding around. But I'm very careful. I can't resist it sometimes. But last night in a speech, I followed Jean Simons, Senator Paul Simons' wife, in a speech in Pittsburgh. And I said that I had directed in 1969 the only television special with Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel, Tell Him I Said Hello. You know, that I could do because I figured, like, everybody knew that was a joke, you know.
Charles Grodin, thanks so much.
Thanks, Terry,
for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been actor Charles Grodin, who starred with Robert De Niro in Midnight Run and has starred in many other films, including The Heartbreak Kid and The Lonely Guy. He's written a new autobiography called It Would Be So Nice If You Weren't Here, and it's just been published by William Morrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, one of India's new wave of young film directors, Ketan Mehta. His film Spices is a story critical of the caste system and the oppression of women in India. I hope you can join us. Here's Charles Grodin in a scene from The Heartbreak Kid.
Look, Mr. Corcoran, I didn't come out here to negotiate for Kelly. I came out here to fight for her. I spent 3 years in the United States Army. I fought every damn minute of those 3 years. Unfortunately, not overseas because of a minor back injury. But in the small army towns of this country, against the narrow-minded, petty...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the 1960s, Tex-Mex rocker Doug Somm met the man he calls the P.T. Barnum of Southern Rock, record producer Huey P. Moe. That's how Somm ended up pretending he was British and passing off his group, the Sir Douglas Quintet, as a British invasion band. Coming up, we find out what Doug Somm's been up to these days, and we hear some of his new album. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Too Long in the Wasteland, the debut album from singer-songwriter James McMurtry. John Cougar Mellencamp produced the album, and Ken says you can really hear the influence. And movie critic Stephen Schiff reviews the latest Broadway hit to attempt the transition to film, Shirley Valentine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A man accused of laundering drug money for the Medellin cocaine cartel arrived in the U.S. today, the first person extradited from Colombia in its recent drug crackdown. Eduardo Martinez Romero is being held without bail in Atlanta. His arraignment was postponed until Monday after he told a magistrate through an interpreter that he doesn't speak English and he doesn't fully understand the charges against him. Investigators claim Romero has helped Colombian drug lords launder $1.5 billion. President Bush brought his anti-drug message to Baltimore today, where he spoke to the American Legion's annual convention. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president plans to crisscross the country the next few weeks to promote the anti-drug strategy he outlined on Tuesday night. Today in Baltimore, he reiterated the policy to the friendly audience of Legionnaires.
As veterans, you know how battles are often fought, house by house, block by block. Well, we'll win this battle the same way, but we're going to win it kid by kid, neighborhood by neighborhood.
The president also used his appearance before the veterans to plug for the proposed constitutional amendment banning flag desecrations. And he marked the anniversary of one of his most famous campaign gaffes. A year ago, also speaking before the Legion, the president stated it was Pearl Harbor Day 3 months prematurely. Today he said that as long as he lives, he'll remember the gasp from the audience. This is Brian Naylor reporting.
A formal inquiry into the explosion aboard the USS Iowa has concluded that Gunner's Mate Clayton Hardwig most likely was responsible. Hardwig and 46 other sailors died in the blast. Rear Admiral Richard Milligan presented the Navy's conclusion at a briefing today. He said although the exact cause can't be pinpointed, it appears Hardwig shoved a detonator between gunpowder bags and one of the battleship's guns. A West German newspaper reported today that preparations are underway for the largest East-West spy swap ever to take place. Dieter Berger has more from Cologne.
According to the conservative daily Die Welt, the swap involving nine countries will take place in late fall. Die Welt has accurately predicted earlier spy swaps. The newspaper says East German lawyer Wolfgang Vogel was in Israel this past weekend to work out details of the exchange. Neither Vogel, a key negotiator in early swaps, nor Israeli sources would comment on the visit. Die Welt says possible candidates for the spy swap include KGB agents in Israel and South Africa, as well as the former Norwegian government official Arne Treholt, who spied for both the Soviet Union and Iraq. East Germany also hopes to swap Western spies for agents of its own in British and West German prisons. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
On Wall Street near the close, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 10.07 points at 2709.72 in moderate trading of 154 million shares. This is National Public Radio News. Police in San Francisco say two gunmen held up an armored car today, killing one guard and injuring another. According to witnesses in the Bank of America headquarters building, the robbers, wearing ski masks and baseball caps, walked into the building after the Brinks guards and opened fire. The witnesses say the gunmen escaped on 10-speed bicycles. Deputy Chief Larry Gurnett said it looked like a well-planned, well-orchestrated robbery. In the U.S. Open men's singles quarterfinals this afternoon, the oldest man left in the competition will play the youngest. David Darcy reports the match will be the meeting of two generations of American tennis.
Before Andre Agassi faced and defeated Jimmy Connors in last year's U.S. Open semifinal, Agassi predicted he'd win easily in straight sets. He did, but the teenager's frankness angered tennis fans and violated what's left of tennis's code of etiquette. That's the only time the two players have met, and the 19-year-old Agassi remains the favorite this afternoon over the 37-year-old Connors, who's playing his 20th U.S. Open. Earlier in the week, however, Connors said he thrived on what he called the zoo atmosphere of the National Tennis Center. Connors' straight sets victory over number 3 seed Stefan Edberg Tuesday may mean that Agassi, who hasn't won a tournament so far this year, could have a struggle against the experienced older player who holds 5 U.S. Open titles. For National Public Radio, this is David Darcy in New York.
Donald Trump is shopping for something from Tiffany's, perhaps most of it. A spokeswoman for the real estate developer says that Trump has received the approval of the Federal Trade Commission to buy more than $15 million worth of Tiffany & Company stock. Tiffany, the glitzy jewelry emporium, conveniently located near the Trump Tower and Trump's Plaza Hotel in downtown Manhattan. The spokeswoman said that Trump was buying the stock for investment purposes only. According to Tiffany Chairman William Cheney, he said in a statement today, the proposed purchase is just for investment. It is not part of any takeover attempt by Trump. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the first album from singer-songwriter James McMurtry, Too Long in the Wasteland.
I'm not from here, I just live here. Can't see that it matters much. Read the papers and I watch the nightly news. Who's to say I'm out of touch?
It's easy to hear why James McMurtry's debut album, Too Long in the Wasteland, has become an instant critic's favorite. McMurtry is a throwback to the sort of singer-songwriter who attracted raves a decade ago. Hard-boiled yet literary guys like Warren Zevon, Guy Clark, and John Prine. In fact, Stephen Holden, writing in the New York Times, has said, "Not since John Prine made his debut in 1971 has a musical voice from the heartland offered such biting images of ordinary Americans living and dying in places far from the lights of the big city." Whew, pretty impressive, huh? Here are some of those biting images that Holden is referring to.
Hear the trucks on the highway and the ticking of the clocks. There's a ghost of a moon in the afternoon. Bullet holes in the mailbox. Bullet holes in the mailbox. Keyholes in my mind. Too long in the wasteland. Too long in the wasteland and falling behind.
That's the title song from James McMurtry's debut album. McMurtry's father is the novelist Larry McMurtry, and I would imagine that the 27-year-old James is already pretty darn sick of being compared to his Pulitzer Prize-winning lonesome dove of a dad. But the comparison is inevitable. Like Larry, James writes about loners, drifters, and rebels. The bleak plains and restless kids that fill Larry McMurtry fiction like The Last Picture Show and Texasville show up in shorthand and set to music in a James McMurtry song like Terry.
Terry's off the track. Send him away and he won't be back for a while. 15 years old. One night he lost control. Straight shots. Staggered out to the parking lot. Someone called him names. He was in no mood for games. He was irate. Court and fate. And it all went off in the blink of an eye. And there's no turning back or questioning why. It was the heat of the moment, a flash in the pan. Blood on the gravel and a long neck in his hand.
There's a certain quality that Larry McMurtry's fiction possesses, however, that James McMurtry's music does not. A sense of humor and appreciation for the absurdity of life. While McMurtry's music is very well written and its images carefully wrought and sustained, the energy level in most of his album's 11 songs is almost as flat as his voice. In fact, to give James a break, I'd say that the novelist his work most closely resembles is not his father at all, but a tough guy sentimentalist like Tom McGuane, who attempts in prose the sort of sodden sentimentality that James does in music.
His bird dogs in the wire cage are barking at the moon. Turn the covers back and hope the dawn don't come too soon. Draw the shades to keep your dark eyes from the glare of the vapor light. But the sheets are cool and empty, and you won't sleep tonight with a half moon rising. And a warm, gusty breeze blowing from the southwest, whispering in the trees.
No matter how many critical raves he receives, I'd be surprised if James McMurtry's album becomes a commercial success. Because just like the critical successes I named earlier, extremely talented people like John Prine and Guy Clark, there's a debilitating self-consciousness at the heart of this music. Listening over and over to Too Long in the Wasteland, I began to think that I'd been, well, too long in the wasteland. I have, however, saved McMurtry's best song for last. His album was produced by John Cougar Mellencamp, and the story goes that when Mellencamp heard a demo tape of McMurtry's songs, he agreed to produce the album, but said, "There's no hit single here. Go home and write me a hit single." I hope James McMurtry learned something about the usefulness of crass realism from that, because the song he wrote to please Mellencamp's canny commercial instincts proves to be the best song on the album. It's called Painting by Numbers, and it really does deserve to be a hit single.
You take a position in the old man's firm. He signs all the papers, you agree to the terms. They'll let you run errands, and you don't get days off. You take out the garbage and hope it pays off, 'cause you're painting by numbers, connecting the dots. You work from the neck down, you don't call the shots. You jump when they say jump, and you don't ask how high. 'Cause painting by numbers, you know you'll get by. Painting by numbers, you know you'll get by.
James McMurtry from Too Long in the Wasteland. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. One of the more influential sounds that came out of Texas in the mid-60s was the Sir Douglas Quintet. It featured Doug Somm on vocals and Augie Myers on organ. Their Tex-Mex sound reflected the musical diversity of San Antonio, R&B, country, blues, and Mexican rhythms. The Sir Douglas Quintet had the hits Mendocino and She's About a Mover. Somm spent a lot of time in Europe and Canada in the 80s. Now he's living in Austin and has his first U.S. release in 7 years. It's called Jukebox Music. Here's I Won't Cry.
Darling, I found out a long time ago. Found someone else, you don't need me anymore. But I'll keep on loving you just the same.
Chose the songs for the new record?
A lot of those are regional hits that were never out of Texas and Louisiana, like Crazy Baby, Your Mind Tonight. There's a regional border sound here. We call a Southern Louisiana West Side sound of San Antonio. It bore on the, you know, the triplets, and a lot of them were just regional hits.
Now, I'm used to hearing you with an organist, Augie Meyer or Flaco Jimenez. How come you did this record without an organ?
Well, this was, you know, that's one thing I realized that I do that most people don't. You know, they do one style, and I don't do one style. I do the Tex-Mex thing. I've had the Sir Douglas Quintet with the organ sound. This record was really meant to be meant to sound rhythm and blues. You know, we really went at it with that. If it would have been my own production, I probably would have mixed it up more, but in a way, it's kind of good because I kept a focus.
Is that you on this record playing all the triplets on the piano?
How did you know? Yeah, we had a working title for this album called Triplets for a Dying World, you know. Because, you know, you don't hear that anymore. You know, it was a real dominant thing during the Fats Domino era. Everything had that ding-ding-ding-ding-ding-ding-ding, had that, you know, triplet thing. And for some reason, with all these modern records, you know, you listen to all the Fine Young Cannibals and all these records that are out now, none of them have triplets.
Do you remember when you first picked up that sound?
When I first heard it, it really got into my brain, was in 53 or 4, which made me 12 years old. I had a friend down the street from where I was raised in San Antonio was really into, see, then rhythm and blues, before his R&B and went into rock and roll, was called race music. And a lot of it had that real good piano work, and Fats had a lot of hits before, you know, Blueberry Hill and Ain't That a Shame. And I just really liked it. And I'd go into the gym, had a real good piano at Sam Houston High School, where I went to school in San Antonio. had a piano, and I'd go in there and play, you know, do that stuff. And finally, I don't know, there's some kind of way I play that rhythm that a lot of guys don't do anymore.
Now, I've read that your mother didn't want you to listen to black music in your house, didn't want you to play black records.
Well, I think the white people, like you see it through Buddy Holly's movies, and, you know, there was a thing. I think the white people realized that the kids were getting into this real black sound, and there was something really scared them, like when Elvis came out and shook his hips, and, you know, with the Clovers doing, you know, One Mint Julep, there was a real frightening air about what this would do to the teenagers, and I happened to be a teenager at that point.
So what music was it okay to listen to in your house?
Well, they were into country. See, growing up there was great because we had country, we had blues. I was raised near a blues club. It was across a field about a mile. I could walk over there and hear T-Bone Walker. Late at night, I'd sneak out of the house and run across over there, and I'd watch T-Bone. Had a little crack in the wind. It's almost like in that Jerry Lee Lewis movie where him and Swagger are little kids, and they sneak across the river. You know that part?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's kind of like that, and we kind of peeped through the window, and we really got the blues into my soul. I could go dig that one night, and then Hank Williams and Bob Wills were all playing around there. So, you know, people always ask me how I got such to be a such cross-culture of music, but I think that's it. I think at a young age it was really born into me. San Antonio was very, very, very beautiful to grow up in at that point.
So when you were a teenager, did you hang out listening to music in black neighborhoods and Mexican neighborhoods in San Antonio?
Oh, absolutely. That was the groove. We would, my school bordered on, it was really interesting. My school, Sam Houston Junior High, and went on to be high school, is now Jeff Davis Junior High. It had a little thing where you went down this road behind it, and once you crossed over, we call it Salal Creek. It's really Salado, but in Chicano slang, we call it the Salal. And when you cross over to it is where all the black places used to be. So we'd go over there, you know, and get a bottle of wine, sneak in there and play them nickel jukeboxes. And it was really a trip because it was a whole strip of nothing but rhythm and blues clubs. I'd have been about 13 or 14. By the time I was 15, I was working all those places.
In the early days of the Sir Douglas Quintet, you passed yourselves off as a British invasion band. Whose idea was that, and what was the logic behind it?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. It was a scam that worked. I don't know if you're old enough, but people watch Tullabaloo.
Yeah.
Trini Lopez, it says, now we'll announce where these guys are really from. It was a big deal because we had, like, really pulled off this number, and, you know, Huey P. Moe, like I call him, the P.T. Barnum of the South, he really pulled a number, and the whole bit really, really worked. We had these long, very regal coats, and, you know, it worked real well.
So whose idea was it to do that, to pass yourselves off as a British invasion band?
Well, me and Huey had the idea, but we didn't really try. It just kind of came out that way. We just kind of set the wheels in motion, and, you know, it really became a phenomenon when we hit England in 65. I just met Brian Jones. Bob Dylan introduced me to Brian Jones. We become good friends, and we were doing a Ready, Steady, Go. I mean, we really caused a phenomenon, Sir Douglas Quintet, when we hit with a hit record in 65 when Pete Townsend was an opening band. That's far out, huh?
Yeah.
Pete Townsend and Jerry Garcia were in opening bands for us in the mid-60s.
That's great. Your 1965 hit, She's About a Mover, was that supposed to sound like a British invasion hit? Did you think of it as sounding that way?
Well, the organ was popular at that point with the Zombies. We really liked the Zombies, and we really liked the Animals, you know. That was Alan Price.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a funkier sound. Like, when that record first broke, I remember Dylan had told me, I think, which sums it up. Everybody was trying to tell Dylan that we were English. He said, no, man, they're not English cats. Listen to that beat and that groove. It's got to be in the southern part of the States. So that's what really worked into breaking that whole Texas thing because, you know, eventually we know that people really know we were from Texas. And, you know, we're Texans and we're proud of it, you know. But you were the walking down the street.
Did you try to put on a British accent?
Oh, we did a few. Pip, pip, man, lovely day. But you got to remember there are three Spanish guys in the band, three Chicanos.
Right.
And every now and then my drummer would break character and go, hey, ¿qué pasó, vato? Hey, ¿qué pasó? What's going on? ¿Cómo está? And all that. And we'd go, hey, man, cool it. And one time in Port Arthur, these two little girls heard that and go, they're not English, man, they're Mexicans. We kind of slipped, but it was fun, you know. Made us a very different bilingual band, you know.
When you recorded The Rains Came in 1966,
yeah.
What phase was the band in then?
Well, that was a strange thing. We had had a hit in 65, and then everything really hit rock bottom about December of that year. My father died. Everybody in the band went through a lot of personal problems. See, at that point, hippies couldn't live in Texas too well. It was a very redneck trip going on. I mean, if people were hassling it because you just wanted to be like the San Francisco people. So the ones that could, like me and Janis Joplin, Johnny Winter, we all left and we went out to California. And we called Huey one day, so I'm going to release The Rains Came. Rains Came, even though it was a big hit for me, I never personally liked it. So we told Huey, hey, man, we're not even going to play that record. He said, well, I'll make you a deal, man, if it gets in the charts, you're going to play it then if it's going to do good? And I said, well, maybe. So we called him one day from Indiana, and the thing had really charted real big, like into the 40s. And then we moved to California, and we didn't have a whole lot going. We were just learning about the music business and collecting royalties and whatever. And Bob Dylan had told me what BMI was, so we'd moved out there with the family. We'd got our first check, and we just started to kind of, you know, we went to L.A. one day, and we saw William Morris Agency, and me and Johnny Perez, a drummer, said, hey, don't those guys book gigs? So we walked in and said, hey, we're the Sir Douglas Quintet. Just walked in off the streets. And they checked it and said, wow, these guys got a 35 with a bullet record. So can you put us to work? And it really is ironic because now, you know, people have to call agents and managers and go through all that. But that's how that happened. Then that happened about a year later after the second follow-up to Mover kind of stiffed and we came back with that. We seem to have a pretty good comeback power.
I'm really surprised you don't like The Rains Came. I think it's a really good record.
Oh, well, people love it. But, I mean, you know, when you make as many records as we do, and I'm sure the Beatles and the Stones, they have their favorites.
Right.
And then there's ones that the people like that they don't like. I mean, there's ones that people love that they don't love. But it does get a reaction when I go, rain, rain. It just, that organ comes in and all that, they just go crazy.
Rain, 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 rain. Tears keep coming down. I haven't seen my baby. Let this down. Rain, 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 rain. My pillow's soaking wet. Broke my heart. Caused me so much pain. Rain, 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 rain.
So you had moved away from Texas for a while because you didn't think it was a very good place for
it wasn't.
For
yeah,
a hippie
it wasn't
to
very
be.
Conducive. I went to Frisco.
Yeah, but well, now you're living in Texas again.
But not for long.
You're moving?
I'm gone again.
Oh, how come?
Well, I tell you, man, I'm a Bay Area fanatic. I mean, I love the Oakland A's. I love the Giants. I love Boskaggs has the greatest club in the country there right now. I just really gel. It's funny. I'm a Texan, but I get along better in a lot of ways in New York, Chicago, L.A., Frisco than I do here. I love it here, but right now it's not, I can't explain it. It isn't really a turn on to me like it was. It's a big kind of little thing turning around now. It's kind of becoming, oh, I don't know. I don't know if it's just age or what, but the South is the South again, and it's kind of like I just like being in the Bay Area. Number one, I'm cooler out there. I like that high of 65 every day instead of 105, you know. But Texas will always be, you know, I'm always here. I got my grandson will be 5 years old next week, you know. And so, I mean, I have heavy ties. I'll always come to Texas, but I really have a strong, very strong ties with the Bay Area.
Well, listen, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Adios.
Doug Somm's new record, Jukebox Music, is on Antone's Records of Austin. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. More on drugs tonight, Linda?
That's right, Terry. The story switches south now. One of the Colombian drug cartel's money men was extradited to Atlanta and arraigned today. And back in Colombia, they're expecting violence because he was extradited. So we'll be looking at that. Also, at the money the president needs to carry out his drug plan, will it be enough and where will he get it? We have the final report on what the Navy believes happened to the Iowa. We have the aftermath of South African elections. And we have your letters tonight.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. After being a hit in London and a hit in New York, the play Shirley Valentine has been adapted for the screen. And this time, film critic Stephen Schiff says Shirley Valentine has gone too far.
High on anyone's list of dramatic cliches is the terminally bored housewife who finally gets out of the kitchen and embarks on a life of her own. The prototype is probably Ibsen's Nora, the heroine of A Doll's House. And when Ibsen wrote that play in 1879, he was well ahead of his time. But when the same character and themes appear now, over a century later, in Shirley Valentine, they seem so pathetically creaky that they really ought to be put in a home somewhere. The movie began as a one-character stage play, a play that got its star, Pauline Collins, an Olivier Award in London and a Tony here. She deserved them both. Playwright Willie Russell's monologue was so hackneyed that only the most winsome of actresses could have kept audience eyelids from collapsing. And this Collins accomplished with style. Not by chewing the scenery, but by underplaying, by allowing her heroine's moon-faced modesty to grow on us. Then, too, there was the charm of sharing a room with Collins. We watched, for instance, as she actually cooked a meal of chips and egg on stage before our eyes. That was enough, at least, to distract us from the yammering of the play's endless reams of insight. In the movie, there's nowhere to run. Every few seconds, it seems our heroine comes up with something gnomic and wise and not quite as witty as the filmmakers think. Here's a sampler.
I think sex is like supermarkets. You know, overrated. Just a lot of pushing and shoving, and you still come out with very little at the end. Oh, my God, 6 o'clock, and his tea isn't ready. Will the government collapse? Does this mean the end of civilization as we know it?
I always have my tea at 6 o'clock.
So just think how exciting it'd be if for once you had it at 6:15. That'd make the headlines. World exclusive. Joe eats late. Manage it like the Middle East. There's no solution.
How much of that can you take? Probably even less than you think. The worst news is that this movie has been opened up from the play. Now it has lots of characters, all of them seeming to be exactly what they are. They're literary conceits. And like some weird breed of zombies, they have temporarily been endowed with bodies and costumes and drecky lines of their own. They're all desperately trying to dress up the tiny plot, which goes like this. Shirley, bored Liverpool housewife with insensitive husband, suddenly goes off to Greece with her best friend, has an affair there, feels liberated, and decides to stay. There's a dreadful amount of talk about finding yourself, rediscovering the youthful Shirley Valentine that years of routine have covered over. And so forth. And it all sounds so irremediably stale that one almost doesn't notice the mean streak running through it. What's crept in during the transition from stage to screen is a condescending tone. Because Shirley frees herself and kicks up her heels, she's suddenly better than everyone around her, better than her poor slob of a husband, better than her friends and fellow tourists who decide to return to their lives and responsibilities rather than stay on in Greece and rediscover their own inner Shirley Valentines. She's even better than Kostas, the Greek restaurant owner she has an affair with. He, after all, will have an empty fling with a new tourist the next week, while Shirley needs only her own newly dusted-off self. Kostas, by the way, is played by Tom Conti, who has a miserable time faking a Greek accent, and so help me, actually has to do a Zorba dance among the tables of his beachside cafe. Ibsen's probably doing something similar in his grave.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Ron Barron, Dan Lachlan, and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about India's film industry with Keaton Mehta, one of that country's new wave of young film directors. Also, we meet best-selling spy novelist Ken Follett. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.